The Guardian. Eating metals, excreting acids, these cells only then later evolved to be able to photosynthesize and then later still to form eukaryotic cells and then become things like plants and Sylvester McCoy.
From a PhD in physics at Cambridge University for a career in comedy, Ben Miller has returned to his roots, publishing his first popular science book, It's Not Rocket Science, in 2012, and now The Aliens Are Coming, published this month. In the book, Ben looks at animal intelligence, the latest search for alien intelligence, and the conditions needed to kickstart life. And he asks what evolution can tell us about extraterrestrial life. Ben joins me in the studio alongside Kit Buchan from Observer Tech Monthly. Ben, perhaps we can start by talking about the impetus for the book. So why did you want to write about what's out there?
When I was writing the first book, It's Not Rocket Science, I had to learn about lots of areas of science I hadn't known particularly that much about before. And I think it was the biology that really sort of sparked my interest, having been more of a kind of physical sciences guy in the past. And I couldn't believe how exciting biology was and human biology. And I got really interested in the idea of what life is, and I've always loved science fiction and alien stories and UFO stories, and I thought, I wonder if there's a way to do the science of aliens, you know, the proper science of aliens. And I think as well, when I was doing the first book, I'd come across lots of little interesting things, all that seemed to be like there was a theme bubbling out there. Maybe this is something I am qualified to do, because arguably got little qualification as a sort of pure science writer, but in terms of someone who knows a bit about a lot of things and knows about culture and popular culture, I thought, well, maybe this is the book that I have a qualification to write.
One of the things you mentioned is how, as a child, you were disappointed by the sort of revelations as sort of people found out more and more about the planets in our own solar system, about how inhospitable they are, and how that was sort of a disappointment.
It was so grim, you know. Yeah, I mean, I was born in 1966. I can just about remember some of the moon landings in 72 and 73, you know, I can just about remember those. And they made a huge impression on me. But the moon, oh my God, it just looked horrendous. I mean, it's just like the most lifeless place you've ever seen. I mean, it's almost the antimatter version of the Earth. It was this kind of weird sort of metallic grim dust everywhere and just nothing. I mean, it was so devoid of life. It seemed like to almost be making a point. And then, you know, yeah, as we sent out all these other probes, you know, the Pioneer and then the Voyager probes and the Russians sent missions to Venus, you know, it just seemed like it was such a barren solar system. It was a really very, very stark place that we found ourselves in. And this is the time, you know, when Carl Sagan makes that show Cosmos and is the famous photo of the Earth, what they call the pale blue dot, taken from the Voyager spacecraft, and you're looking back at the solar system and just the idea that all there is this tiny pixel in a sort of vast existential nothingness. You know, that was very much where we got to in the sort of mid-late 70s. It was really grim.
I mean, things have picked up a bit now. We've got, you discovered exoplanets.
It's almost the opposite now.
So it seems to be a new one popping up every week. Sometimes in habitable zones, and it all looks a bit more positive.
Well, this is another reason why I felt I was uniquely qualified for the book. It's like my age. I happen to have lived, you know, I've lived this stuff. I mean, I was doing my undergraduate, you know, one of my things I loved, one of the subjects I loved and I specialised in when I did my degree was the physics of stars and galaxies. And I was really into how galaxies formed and stars. I mean, you know, I remember sitting there in a lecture and, you know, them saying, well, we don't know that there are other solar systems out there. It's possible, but no one's ever found them. And we've looked really, really carefully. We haven't found one single other solar system. So this could be it. And then just after I finished my PhD, So it would be the early 90s. Somebody said, oh, wow, we found a planet. It's amazing. But it was just the weirdest thing ever. It was like something the size of Jupiter going around I think it probably was a red dwarf star, in like days, like 3 days or something. You think, really? Really? And again, you just think, wow, we really are on our own. You know, if there's other stuff out there, it's like that. And even then, that wasn't confirmed. And then that was questioned, and that wasn't then reconfirmed until about 5 years later. So it was very sort of stop-start to begin with. And now, you know what, there's 2,000 and counting solar systems, and we know that, you know, maybe a fifth to a half of all solar systems have Earth-like planets. That's just incredible. There's billions of them out there in our own galaxy. It's just, that's a lot of Earths.
Is it now no longer far-fetched, then, to suggest that there might be alien life forms, just on a statistical level?
Well, I think there's a bit like, you know, saying you think, you know, sitting here on, you know, in our own solar system and saying you think there are other solar systems out there, when you've got no evidence. There's just no evidence for it, sadly. There's just no evidence for life anywhere other than here. There's a few tiny squeaks. You know, there's the Allen Hills meteorite, the Martian meteorite that landed in Antarctica, that seems to have very, very small, I mean, cell fragments, or very, very, they're very, very small to be, they're too small to be cells almost, but it looks like biological matter in them. That's pretty much it. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of other evidence. Knowing what we know now about life on Earth, you know, it seems that you require a volcanic planet to create life. It's the volcanism, essentially, these are the engine that supplies, you know, transition metals and energy, electrochemical energy to the seabed, and creates a place where life can kind of get kick-started. That happened very early on Earth. I mean, you can pretty much say life on Earth worked straight out of the box, really. I mean, it seems to be there 4 billion years ago, when it has no right to be there, because the Earth is being bombarded by asteroids. So it's really hard to understand how it could have got started so quickly. So we have that. I mean, that's kind of evidence that life, you know, is reasonably easy to start. But on the other hand, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation if microbial life hadn't got started really early on Earth and given us time to evolve. So again, you would just end up back in the same place. There is zero evidence. But, you know, if we are allowed to talk about those things which we believe but cannot prove, yeah, I believe that bacterial life is widespread. Why wouldn't it be? It'd be really odd if there's just loads and loads of Earth-like planets out there with water on them and, you know, weather systems and that are volcanic and yet there's no life. That would be really strange. You can see how a tiny little thing like the moon, with no volcanicity to power anything, there's no energy source, you can see how that might not have life. But, you know, come on.
Come on. Make an effort.
Earth-like planets, come on, make an effort. Yeah.
Do you have a pet prediction of how we might first discover life, if we do, within our own lifetimes?
I do, yeah. For now, Miller's theory. basically, yeah, within about, I think, Kepler Space Telescope did a brilliant job of finding solar systems, but they're a long, long way away. So it was pointed at a part of the star field which is very dense to give it the maximum chance of finding other planets. By definition, they're all a very, very long way away, too far away, really, for us to be able to find out that much more about them for the next few decades. Now we know that there's planets out there. Now we have to point our telescopes at nearby stars and find nearby planets and image those. Basically, an infrared telescope can pick up the light coming from that planet and can look at, more or less, read off the barcode of which gases are in its atmosphere. And if the gases are not in chemical balance, say, for example, someone looking at the Earth from a few light years out might say, hang on a minute, you know, what's causing all those oxidizing gases? What's oxygen doing in the atmosphere? That doesn't make any sense. Then you could spot something like that on a nearby planet and say, something's fishy there. That's as far as we'll get. Yeah, possibly, literally. Yeah, and say, yeah, look, that planet there, that looks like it's got life on it. And if it's close enough, you bet we're going to send something there. We're going to send something there. We're humans. That's exactly what we'll do. I mean, can you imagine how focused NASA will be once we know, not only we found a nearby planet, it's got a non-equilibrium atmosphere. Let's send something there.
One of the things you touch on is perhaps one of our most bizarre forms of trying to communicate, as you've been mentioning there, with life forms out there, is when we sent the golden records on the Voyager missions. Presumably that was sort of with the idea that whatever's out there has some technology or intelligence similar to ourselves and would be able to interpret whale song and Chuck Berry.
Yeah, so the golden record, you know, for anybody who just needs their minds refreshing on that, basically this was curated by, amongst others, Carl Sagan. It basically was exactly what it sounds like. It was a... Another fact is made of gold. It's sort of very random, isn't it? It's a very fancy record. It basically had recordings of lots of different stuff. I mean, literally a sort of random things like washing machines and whale song. And there's no explanation of any of this on the record. It's just all recorded. There's various bits of music, you know, bits of Beethoven, bits of Chuck Berry, lots of voices speaking Sumerian, one of the first languages we think was actually put into written form, and there are images on there as well. And the odd thing is that the aliens need to, I think there's a needle with it. And it's no machine to play the record. I think there's a stylus. I think maybe they just have to figure out what it is.
There's a manual.
And there's no manual. There's no explanation of how to play the record that I'm aware of on the record itself. There is a case. And there's various kind of other things drawn on the case, you know, like a picture of a man and a woman and our location relative to the nearest, you know, 14 pulsars or something.
But sort of we're here map.
We are here. There's a measurement of time. You know, there's a drawing of a hydrogen molecule from which the aliens are supposed to work out that we're referring to the hyperfine transition of hydrogen, which is the point at which the proton and electron spins move from being parallel to anti-parallel. They give out a certain wavelength of light, but that's supposed to be I mean, and they're supposed to work out from that. That's then coded, I think, in binary, so they can work out how fast they need to spin. If they figure out, they've got to rotate the record. I mean, it's just brilliant. It's a brilliant. But what it is, I think, like a lot of these, you know, it's a great way of framing the question. So, how do you? I mean, if you want to communicate, how do you communicate? You know, what could you possibly send? What thing or message could you possibly send that your cultures would have in common? And that's a really difficult, that's a very deep question, actually, and not one that I think Carl Sagan was unaware of when he, you know, tacked all that stuff to one of the struts of the Voyager and kicked it off into outer space. So I think they were very, very much aware that it was all bizarre and random.
Presumably it's not just a cultural thing, it's also our idea of what form does life take. I mean, that, as I was saying, you sort of has this very implicit idea that whatever life might be out there is going to be not, I was going to say, a million miles away from us, but obviously it's a lot further away from us than that. But in terms of its form, you know, what it would look like. I mean, now it seems we're edging more towards this idea that if there is life out there, it's going to be microbial in form or something of that sort. I mean, is that the latest sort of state of play, that it's some sort of single-celled organisms? Or...
Yeah, I think, I mean, if you were to sort of really briefly sum it up, I think that, yeah, the idea is that bacterial, you know, microbial life is common, and we're really at the moment we just restrict this to Earth-like planets. We're only talking about planets like the Earth. You know, we're leaving out of the equation other kinds of life forms, you know, that might have completely different, and non-cellular, and might have completely different organizational structures, and that those aren't ruled out by any means. But we tend to just restrict ourselves for the moment to talking about Earth-like planets. Yeah, we think there would be microbial life, and we think that would be widespread, but there seems to be a kind of a bottleneck, really, in the evolution of life on Earth, what you might call complex life, and to restrict it even more, complex intelligent life appears to be pretty rare. I mean, there seems to have been only one event that we can find in evolutionary history that led to, further down the line, the evolution of complex organisms, one of which happens to be us. And that, basically, to cut a long story short, was the creation of the eukaryotic cells. We've got various kinds of simple cells around from the very beginning of the Earth, two kinds, the archaea and the bacteria in particular, both doing very well, thank you very nicely, thank you very much, for billions of years until, you know, sometime, maybe a billion, maybe a billion and a half years ago, the eukaryotic cell was created, where one type of simple cell attempted to engulf but didn't quite manage to destroy another kind of cell. And we think the archaea basically tried to engulfed a bacteria and enslaved a bacterium. And these, we find these in our own cells, are called mitochondria. They supply the energy that enables the huge information overhead of complex organisms. So it's good news and bad news. Bad news, that appears to be a bottleneck. The good news, the traits that we look for in other creatures, intelligence, civilization, culture, these are really common, we now know, among other animal species on Earth. So among complex organisms, humans aren't that unique, is one of the interesting discoveries, but complex organisms themselves may well be rare. So you've got a situation, really, where, this is how I think of it anyway, bacterial life probably on many Earth-like planets, but very few intelligent, communicable organisms that are capable of sending us a signal at exactly the right time. It's a timing issue, basically. Intelligent life is out there, but just never quite at the right time, probably, for us to be able to speak to one another or signal to one another.
It would require an immense coincidence for us to be massive around and receiving.
We think with our own technology, because civilizations might last thousands of years, but technologies don't. You know, we're already, you know, we were looking for radio signals. Well, arguably, we don't really use them anymore in interstellar communications. We now use lasers. And, you know, who knows how long we'll use lasers for before we use something else to send signals. So it's kind of, it's a timing problem. It's a massive timing problem.
Presumably, there's also the question of the fact that we send out our signals now, but it's going to take time for those signals to travel across the universe to wherever they might be received.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, the signals that we do send are so weak. It's true, we have been, you know, we've been broadcasting radio signals since middle of the 20th century, but they're very weak. They won't get very far. They won't get more than 10 light years or so. And we're just not expecting there to be any intelligent life within the next 10 light years. So it's really unlikely they've been picked up. We have sent stronger signals. You know, we've sent not many, but a few. There's a famous one, the Arecibo message, you know, which was a digital message that, again, was sent, I think, in the early 1970s. That was aimed at a cluster of galaxies so far away, but by the time they pick it up and signal back to us, I mean, not only will the people who sent the signal not be alive, but it's arguable whether humanity will still be on the planet.
One of the things you mentioned in the book is that the Italian physicist Enrico Fermi suggested that intelligent aliens might be out there, but they might not have thought it worthwhile, basically, to get in touch with us. Is that something?
Well, this
that
is
you...
a fascinating question, yeah. So I've basically just made the argument that bacterial life is common, but intelligent life is rare, so rare that the timing is rarely good enough that we wouldn't expect to pick up signals. Well, you know, there's a counter argument to that, which was put forward by Enrico Fermi, which is that, you know, why don't they colonize? You know, why doesn't some other intelligent species gradually colonize the galaxy? If they are here in the galaxy, it wouldn't take that long for them to spread out to neighboring stars and eventually reach our corner of the cosmos. Why aren't they here? You know, why aren't aliens here? That's not really answered by anything that I've said. You know, I mean, you've got to come up with another argument why they haven't colonized. You can make up an argument as to why we haven't received signals. And I guess for me, again, it would be about the distances. I think we just that's a long way to the nearest star. I mean, it's a long, long way. One of the things I try and do in the book is follow the energy all the way through. Because I think in physics, we're on fairly firm ground always when we look at what's happening to the energy. So where's the energy coming from? Where's the energy coming from to travel those immense distances? What's staying alive over those immense distances? Well, nothing biological. So, I mean, why has the galaxy not been colonised by robots? That's a very, very hard question to answer. The answers are the distances are either too great and they don't bother, or we're the only thing around.
You touch on the existence of extremophiles here on Earth as part of looking sort of out there. It seems almost that the search for discovering more out there is making us look closer at what we have here.
Yeah.
Is that something that you found whilst you were researching in the book?
This is an incredible area, really. I mean, it's a sort of burgeoning area of biology. So what's caused this sea change, this move from a belief that there's nothing out there to a belief that there might be all kinds of stuff out there is really down to sort of three areas. One are incredible telescopes that are telling us that there are planets out there. Secondly are better understanding of how life got started on Earth and therefore how it could be started on other planets. But thirdly, and kind of most importantly, is this discovery of extremophiles. These living organisms, single-celled organisms, but living organisms that can survive in just ridiculous environments, you know, inside nuclear reactors and in pools of sulfuric acid. And I mean, it's just unbelievable. The range, life isn't what we thought it was. It's not some fragile thing that, you know, ekes out an existence in a sort of sweet spot where everything's just right. It just finds its way everywhere. The other really interesting thing that comes out of the sort of study of extremophiles is that we're extremophiles ourselves, you know, that the extremophiles are kind of the how things started, because life on Earth didn't begin in sunlight in temperatures of 18 degrees centigrade. It began on the seabed in hot, hot volcanic vents with no light whatsoever, eating metals, excreting acids. These cells only then later evolved to be able to photosynthesize, and then later still to form eukaryotic cells and then become things like plants and Sylvester McCoy.
One question is, if we become more aware that it isn't purely an eccentric experiment to imagine, you know, a sort of Carl Sagan-esque golden record flown into space of an experiment to imagine that there might be alien life, does that then divide people when it gets too real? When the chance of alien life becomes more possible, let's say we were to discover microbial life on an asteroid or something, doesn't that change our otherwise sort of quite homely interest in whether or not there might be something out there too, what would surely divide some people into a kind of state of abject panic?
Yeah, it does, and I can't wait for that day. I mean, it does. It's going to change everything. Yeah, it's going to change everything. It will totally, not for long, we will assimilate it very quickly like we do everything else, but it will change everything over a very, very brief shock period. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get hokey, but, you know, one of the great organisations on this planet is the UN, and we don't use it. You know, we don't... Yeah, are so concerned with our, you know, dividing our cultures and, you know, keeping other people out and let's be here and let's... I mean, I find all that lack of Star Trek-like federalism, I find that really depressing. I mean, we really need to think as a species about everything that we do on this planet and thinking about how we would communicate with other civilizations, what we would want to say, how we might say what we can say, what version of ourselves do we want to present, what would we hope to gain? You know, what would we hope for them to gain? These are aspirational questions. Sometimes, I have to admit, over the last sort of few years, burrowing away, writing my little sort of book about talking to aliens, you kind of think, this does seem quite petty, what we're all really, really worried about. There's sort of bigger issues here as a species and as a planet and as a... You know, because one of two things is true. Either we're the only thing here, in which case it's incredibly important we get it right, or we're not the only thing here, which means it's incredibly important we get it right.
In terms of the current missions that are out there, so there are quite a few probes and things that are exploring the solar system. You've got, for example, the Curiosity rover that's on Mars, analysing all sorts of Martian terrain. Are you optimistic that there are going to be exciting results that are coming out from that?
I've got to be honest with you. There's not a lot coming down the pipe. It's really quite disappointing, actually. If you look at actual planned missions and missions that are capable of detecting life, it's really depressing. I mean, the Huygens probe has just left Enceladus. Enceladus, as you know, has got this amazing plume, this huge geyser of water that's ejected up into interstellar space. I mean, it's just extraordinary. The Huygens probe has left. There's a European mission to Europa. I don't think it leaves until something like 2017, 2018, and then it's going to take ages to get there. And there's just not really much out there. There's this very exciting discovery of running water on Mars, but the last thing that landed on Mars that would be capable of detecting life was the Beagle. And that didn't turn out too well. You know, it's really depressing. It's not a lot. We're not doing a lot. We should do more. We should do more to try and find microbial life in our own solar system. But I do think as we find more planets, more Earth-like planets, and we image the atmospheres of those planets, we'll get more and more excited about the possibility that there is microbial life in our own solar system. And this is not pointless. You know, the discovery of extremophiles, for example, has enabled giant leaps forward in medicine. You know, we find all kinds of proteins and weird kind of complexes in extremophiles that we can directly employ in biotechnology and have made a huge difference to our everyday lives. If you found such a thing as an alien microbe, that's enough material to completely revolutionise the whole of biotechnology. I mean, it's not for nothing. It's not like a minor curiosity that there might be bacterial life in the solar system. You know what I mean? This is a big deal.
Since Carl Sagan's time, if there's been a sort of gulf, black spot in our interest in space, do you feel that that's firing up again? And do you think the potential introduction of private companies into space exploration is good news in the sense that it could mean that we work a lot faster and find out a lot more in a shorter space of time, or are you apprehensive about that?
I think the commercialisation of space is a good thing. I mean, so much space exploration to date has been state-sponsored, and states and governments understandably have their own agendas. You know, I think I'd like to see a colony on on the moon. I'd like to see a colony on Mars. I'd like to see us build some kind of base on the moon where we could build. Seems kind of crazy to keep having to send rockets from Earth up into space. You know, that does seem quite mad to me. It makes much more sense to do that, to send stuff around the solar system from the moon where you're out of the atmosphere. Ultimately, there'll be a huge saving, you know, a huge cost saving in launching stuff from the moon rather than... It would have made much more sense, for example, once we'd landed on the moon, to build a colony there and then to assemble our ships there and send the rockets off from there. That would make much more sense. I'm sure in the long run that's what we'll do. And I think, yeah, the fact that there's water on Mars, that's got to be good news. So we could have a colony on Mars, and I'm sure we will. You know, it'll be because of mining, and it'll be because of all kinds of other reasons, but it has to be commercial. The question is how you make sure that it's done responsibly, isn't it? And the question is how we make sure that we don't do the same sort of stuff on the moon and on Mars that we've done on Earth, you know. We don't have a great track record, do we?
Given that it seems quite likely that what's out there might be more likely to be microbial type in form, do you think that we should stop trying to send out communications into the forms of radio waves and all that sort of stuff?
No, I think we should do that more. I think we should try and communicate more, and I think we shouldn't be so precious about what we send. I don't think we need to try and figure out what messages we need. I just think we should just send as much stuff as possible, as much information as we possibly can, because the chances of there being any kind of cultural overlap by which another civilization is able to recognize any of the information that we're sending as information, I think, is so small that we just need to just send a lot. You know, I think we need to send stronger signals, and I think we should signal more. I think we should signal our intent to communicate, and I think maybe if we do that, then we might get communicated with, you know.
They might be into jazz or something.
They might be into jazz, yeah, yeah. And there's certainly plenty of it on the Golden Record, if that's their thing, yeah. I mean, I you know, as I say, the sort of distances and the timing problem is massive, so, you know, it won't be us that gets the signal back, so we needn't worry. This will be like generations' time. If it all goes really badly, this will be in generations' time. We don't need to worry. We really don't need to worry about it.
Ben Miller's book, The Aliens Are Coming, is out now. A big thank you to Ben Miller and Kit Buchan for joining me in the studio. That's all we have for you this week. From me, Nicola Davis, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
Men of Science Weekly, we've teamed up with our friends at Cornerstone to give you an offer that'll save you time, money, and give you a closer shave. With Cornerstone, you'll never have to worry about your blades being blunt again. They'll deliver their super sharp, award-winning German-engineered razors right to your door. Just visit cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly, enter your initials so they can be engraved on the heavy-duty aluminium handle, and pick the delivery scheme that suits you best. And because you listen to Science Weekly, Cornerstone are giving you £10 of your first order, and if you're not 100% satisfied, Cornerstone will give you your money back with no questions asked. Head to cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly and discover an even better way to shave, starting from as little as £4. That's cornerstone.co.uk/scienceweekly.